Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky, and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the Indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I would now like to introduce this morning's panel, Stephanie Pasquale, Arlena Harris, and Bill Simmons. Stephanie Pasquale is the Director of Neighborhood Advancement with the Allen Family Foundation. The foundation, founded in 1954, is committed to a collaborative partnership with organizations and the community to build a responsible and vibrant Central New York. In her role at the foundation, Stephanie collaborates with government, nonprofit, community, and private partners to deliver on place-based housing and neighborhood redevelopment strategies that support inclusive, thriving neighborhoods. Additionally, she is serving as the interim CEO of the newly founded Blueprint 15 nonprofit Community Quarterback, an organization charged with delivering on a bold vision for the holistic revitalization of the East Adams Street neighborhood. Stephanie earned her Master's of Public Administration and Bachelor of Arts in Policy Studies from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, where she later served as an adjunct faculty member for more than 10 years. She also serves on numerous boards in the community. Arlena Harris was born and raised on the south side of Syracuse and is a proud graduate of the Syracuse City School District. She went on to earn her BA of Psychology at the University of Rochester in 2014 with interests in child development, community mental health, and suicide prevention. Following undergrad, she worked as a youth development professional at Elmcrest Children's Center. After gaining valuable insight into direct care, she decided to shift her focus on addressing larger systemic issues that create barriers within communities. She went on to attend Syracuse University's Fault College and earn her MSW with a concentration on macro-level social work. She is heavily involved in projects that drive community wellness through her role at the board of Cafe Sankofa, a Black-led culture and wellness cooperative located on the south side of Syracuse. She also serves as a Food Sense site coordinator, which is a program that provides healthy and affordable food to families in need. She is also currently an owner and partner of Our Glass Consulting LLC, which focuses on transforming workplace culture through DEI leadership and fulfillment training. Arlena currently serves as the Director of Community Partnerships at Blueprint 15, where she works with community residents, local leaders, and other stakeholders to develop a shared vision for the holistic revitalization of the East Adams neighborhood. William J. Simmons, Esquire, is the Executive Director of Syracuse Housing Authority, responsible for upholding the Housing Authority's mission and vision of providing quality, safe, and affordable housing, and the overall empowerment of and self-sufficiency of its residents. At the Housing Authority, he oversees 2,440 public housing units, 184 tax credit units, 97 units of affordable housing, and the administration of contracts for approximately 3,600 rental units as part of the authority's Housing Choice Voucher Program. A native of Bronx, New York, Simmons has lived in Syracuse since 1975, was the director of airport services at Syracuse Hancock International Airport, served as board commissioner on the Syracuse City School Board, and was a 5th District Syracuse Common Counselor. Simmons graduated with his Juris Doctor from Syracuse University's College of Law in 2004 and has been a member of the New York State Bar Association since 2006. Presently and for the past 10 years, Simmons has played an integral role in shaping the New York State Department of Transportation's plans for the redevelopment of the Interstate 81 Viaduct, which has divided SHA's Pioneer Homes public housing neighborhood since the 1950s. Anticipating the New York State DOT's decision would reshape the region's future for generations to come, Simmons and SHA initiated a proactive neighborhood planning process that began in 2015 by holding meetings with residents, community stakeholders, and elected officials. From those meetings came the preferred concept plan, which included mixed income housing, mixed use and commercial properties, and established a vibrant commercial corridor for this part of the urban core. Within the footprint of the preferred concept plan area, known today as East Adams Street Neighborhood Transformation Project, sits over 1,000 units of public housing on the 118 square acres of land majorly owned by SHA. In addition to his position as executive director, Simmons serves on a variety of community boards as well. Please join me in welcoming Stephanie, Arlena, and Bill.
Thanks so much for having us today. Really, really glad to be here bright and early on this beautiful morning here in Syracuse. Sorry about that. So we thought we'd talk a little bit about today about what the heck is Blueprint 15 and this organization, as well as, and Bill will certainly share all that SHA is involved in and their role in this project. But really want to just give you a little overview of how is this organization formed and why. About 3.5 years ago, some folks in the community learned about something called purpose-built communities, a national model for looking at disrupting the cycle of generational poverty and creating durable pathways to economic independence. And as they came to town, and I think there was some suspicions, like, how are you going to do this? What are you talking about? This sounds like too good to be true. They started looking at several neighborhoods in Syracuse, collecting data, asking lots of, you know, probing questions about, you know, what makes for a good purpose-built neighborhood and a revitalization project. And obviously, all of the things you heard about in Bill's intro and that he'll touch upon later regarding both that sort of confluence of the redevelopment of the I-81 viaduct and all of the public housing and affordable housing that's located in that area, it seemed like a good fit for something like a purpose-built community model. So why the East Adams neighborhood? In addition, not just because of the highway project or just because of some of the age and some of the condition of housing that's going to be needed to be replaced at some point or upgraded. There's so many assets in this neighborhood and there's so many opportunities that this affords that we hope that we can connect residents to. So the mission and vision of the organization really is to serve as this community quarterback of sorts, and I'll talk a little bit about that, to help coalesce a three-pronged vision. Incredibly high-quality mixed-income housing is one of the three legs to the purpose-built stool, and you're going to hear a lot about that today. The other two legs of the stool, though, include, you know, best-in-class age zero to college education and career pipeline. And health and wellness is the third leg of the stool. So it's not just a housing effort, it's not just an educational effort, and it's not just a health and wellness effort. It really is a holistic approach to neighborhood revitalization and inclusive revitalization. We want to make sure that residents that live in this neighborhood are part of all of these opportunities and solutions that will be proposed for the neighborhood. So I thought I'd share with you guys, what is a community quarterback? And what is the purpose-built, you know, sort of, you know, model? And it really centers around having an organization that is accountable to all of those efforts. Again, it's not just about any one of those three legs of the stool. And any one of those three legs is massive. This doesn't happen without incredible partnerships and incredible sort of buy-in from all the necessary anchor institutions and partners and residents in the community. But really, after 25 years of trying this approach, we were the 25th purpose-built community selected into the network. I think there's 28 now. But all of these organizations are various stages of their growth. But the one that this was modeled after initially in Atlanta is 25 years old. And there's organizations that are young and new like us and everywhere in between. And what we can benefit from and what we have benefited from are both the excellent work that's come out of these processes, but also the lessons learned and what we want to pick and choose from what folks have learned over the years to be most effective here. So to be part of this network, which allows us not just this great information, but free pro bono consulting services from Purpose Built, including their pro bono services around the Purpose Built schools model. And that's a key component to what we're trying to accomplish. You have to create a community quarterback. That was mandatory. It was part of the deal. So it's a newly formed single purpose organization. That's Blueprint 15. That our effort, our board, everyone involved in this process settles for nothing less than the best. All of the efforts and best practices that we look at, whether it's from design to urban planning to an early learning center for ages 0 to 5, that we're looking at providing and producing best in class for this neighborhood. Our job is to figure out how the heck are we going to fund this sustainably, not just build the stuff from a real estate perspective, but fund it operationally for years and years to come. That this effort is connected and coordinated. There's so many moving parts. Our organization is responsible for making sure this communication flowing between all the different entities, that we're coordinating, that we're not working in silos. All of our work, and you'll hear from Arlena Harris on our team, is connected to the people in our neighborhood. That's the center. That's everything, is listening to, responding to, and creating these opportunities for people to not just give us their opinion, but to genuinely be involved in the redevelopment of this effort and in figuring out whatever pathways to economic prosperity work for their family, and how do we connect, make sure that those are available and continue to be met throughout the process. And just to me, it all centers, and I think our board really feels it, that it centers around accountability, and that the buck stops here with this organization, and that we're not just saying all these beautiful things, that we know this is going to be a long haul. It's going to be a messy haul, but we're in it, and we have an amazing and engaged board. Bill is on our board, as well as two commissioners from SHA and two residents from the Housing Authority. We have representatives, the superintendent from the school district, from upstate Syracuse University, Center State CEO, the faith community, other neighborhood groups, residents, and elected officials. And everyone's feeling and genuinely engaged in this idea of accountability, and that the buck stops here. So what have we been focused on? So what the heck does all this mean? Really in 2021 and in 2020, in the last 12 months, we've been trying to build our, you know, resident engagement effort to make sure and to complement and support other engagement efforts that have been occurring in the neighborhood. But through that effort, Syracuse was able to apply for and secure a grant for $1 million through the Enterprise Community Partners to create what they call an anti-displacement plan. And all the other cities that participated, the other 9 cities, are creating anti-displacement plans for their entire city. Syracuse was the only city selected to focus on this neighborhood in particular to prevent displacement. And there's many, many considerations for that. But our team that was made up of, you know, folks, again, from that the same sort of partnership list I just listed, really focused on the following sort of 4 core strategies that we're using the grant to do. We want to establish a community support and resident center in the footprint, and we're working with, there's a private firm made up of, you know, folks that do development that are from the neighborhood, looking to convert a building, a land bank owned building on the corner of Montgomery and Burt Street that has first floor commercial, second floor apartments, and that'll be our forever home that we hope to move in the fall. We're hoping to use these funds to create a barrier reduction fund. As you guys can imagine, there's all kinds of unanticipated costs or barriers that can occur to folks, make sure they stay, that they, if they want to stay in the neighborhood, that they're able to do so throughout the development phase. We're working to create a housing trust fund so that we can fund the renovation of property and building new in the footprint. To ensure there's really high quality opportunities for people to move into should relocation be necessary, or if people are interested in home ownership, and you'll learn a little bit about this from Arlena, really get people on that pathway and make sure if they want to, that there's homes available to purchase in the footprint. And access to free and accessible eviction prevention and other legal services that help with debt reduction and other tenant advocacy services right in the neighborhood. So again, our number one priority is centering resident voice and participation in every aspect of this initiative. And I know that there's this huge focus on, and there should be, and Bill will talk about the development area and where the Housing Authority's land is located and what the plan, you know, how that planning process will look like. But our board felt strongly that they want this organization to also represent what we call the southern part of our footprint. So if you can picture, from East Adams Street to the north, down to West Colvin to the south, from Salina to the west, to Almond or the highway to the east, that we're also supporting and identifying opportunities for redevelopment particularly, as I mentioned, with the Housing Trust Fund, whether it's renovating existing property, helping families if they ever wanted to build wealth through home ownership or through small scale rental property ownership management, that we're able to do that to help revitalize the southern part of that footprint as well. So what are we doing right now? We're continuing to build our team. We're posting for some positions. We were fortunate to be, again, through a grant to help support that, to help do this work. We moved into the Educational Opportunity Center, the EOC, at 100 New Street, which is a great partnership to also help push out all of the wonderful work and activities that they do and make sure our residents feel that they're connected to that place just as, and see all the value that's available. We're obviously partnering with the city of Syracuse and home headquarters, where their home headquarters is already constructing 4 new homes in the footprint. We hope 2 more this season if we can pull it off. And we started having home ownership, home buyer orientation workshops and home ownership classes specifically geared towards residents of this footprint in hopes that they're able to purchase if they're interested these properties that are being built. Been working hard with the school district and just the amazing, amazing team at Dr. King, esteem at Dr. King Elementary, on learning more about the purpose-built schools model and working towards a project-based learning whole STEAM experience there. We've been connecting with potential funders to secure short and long-term opportunities. One of the wonderful things about being part of this purpose-built network is we're on the map now with some national funders that maybe never considered Syracuse in the past. As an investment for their funding investments. And we're just always working on ongoing community engagement and prepping for master planning. So I'm gonna stop there and hand it off to Arlene to talk about all the amazing work she's doing around community engagement.
Thank you for having us. So as Stephanie mentioned, one of our main priorities is to build resident power so that, you know, residents not only can participate, but they are at the center of this initiative and leading this initiative. So a lot of my work has been around building a neighborhood navigator program, which is essentially our version of a credible messenger. And so these are trusted members of the neighborhood who play a key role in really engaging with their neighbors to learn about the wants and needs of the community, to keep residents informed and actively engaged in every stage of this redevelopment process, to make sure that they understand that we're in this for the long haul, and that, you know, we're trying to build those connections between residents, Blueprint 15, and other partners that are involved. And also to ensure that, you know, all programming services and planning are designed by, for, and, you know, with neighborhood residents. So to date, we've held a total of 4 pop-up pantries. We learned really early on that food was a major concern and challenge among our residents. So, you know, we held these pop-up pantries where we provided food boxes from the food bank, as well as COVID resources and other items to kind of help people, you know, get through this pandemic. With each pop-up, we learned more and more about the community's needs, and we kind of pivoted to ensure that, you know, we were able to meet people where they were at. So for example, you know, in the winter months when it was getting cold, we were able to facilitate with Syracuse Housing Authority and a bunch of other partners to deliver these food boxes, as opposed to people having to come out and stand in the cold, you know, and those types of things. So, you know, we really ensure that, you know, our flyers and the different programs that we have are all translated into the different languages that our residents speak so that everybody has an opportunity to be a part of it or to access that information. We've been collecting life needs assessments and doing door-to-door outreach to kind of connect people with service providers in the area to ensure that, you know, some of those short and long-term needs can get met while we prepare for this master planning process. We've held home ownership orientations and financial empowerment workshops. We had about 12 people participate in our first home ownership orientation, and we have about 7 people who are prepared to take the home buyer class, which is kind of the next step in that process in April. So really excited about trying to help them on that pathway, since there's a lot of challenges and it's a bumpy road to achieve that. We've also been doing tenant rights and eviction prevention trainings with the Onondaga Volunteer Lawyers Project, just really around spreading awareness and providing information about tenant rights and that tenant hardship declaration form, especially because a lot of people are struggling during COVID. And then we've had a lot of just ongoing connections with community organizations and service providers to ensure that everyone knows kind of what's going on, and that we can learn from them what challenges that they've heard from residents who are currently living in our area, and how we can more collaboratively work together to ensure that we are meeting people's needs, both short term and long term. We've currently connected with a total of 525 families and collected about 393 surveys. So, you know, as the weather kind of gets warmer and things are kind of starting to open up, we're just really looking forward to being able to have that visual presence and really connect with people. You know, everybody's kind of going through these stages of isolation, and we want to ensure that, you know, residents feel prioritized in this initiative and they're updated, they're involved and empowered to, you know, be a part of this and share kind of, you know, what their needs are, what their wants are, what their hopes are for their community, and what they want their neighborhood to look like.
Bill, why don't you take us from here and talk a little bit about, just a little bit, I'm only kidding, talk as much as you want about all the hard work you guys have been doing and just your incredible partnership with this effort.
Yeah, thank you, Stephanie and TMR, for this invitation this morning. It's good to be here. It has been a while since I've been in front of TMR. But yeah, I just want to remind many of our audience that this process really started, or the formation of it started, when the Congress and the Department of Housing and Urban Development over the last 15 years started to really divest itself of public housing and has created to date a $70 billion capital backlog in deferred maintenance for public housing across the country. And so back in 2011, HUD came out with a program that allowed housing authorities to reposition their properties by using public-private financing for that effort. And this is in the form of the primary form of getting this redevelopment done in the low-income housing tax credit program that is the real major tool for developing and redeveloping affordable housing throughout the nation. And so the combination of having to reposition our properties, as you know, Pioneer Homes is is the first housing authority in New York State, development built in 1937, and one of the first five in the country. And so with looking at this opportunity, as well as the I-81 challenge, we decided to do a master plan. And part of that master plan was myself, Van Robinson, and some of the city administration back in 2014, being invited to San Francisco, where the back in 1989, the Embarcadero highway collapsed through the earthquake. And the Congress for New Urbanism invited us out there to look at what could be done in a neighborhood where the highway is not rebuilt. And so it was, and you know, coming back from San Francisco, I started thinking about, okay, well, how do you negotiate enhancements for your community when you're fighting with potentially displacement, when you're fighting with eminent domain issues? And so the folks from the Congress of New Urbanism said, you know, Bill, there's a environmental justice executive order that President Clinton put in place back in 1993 that was designed just for these kinds of neighborhoods that are low income and predominantly of color, that you automatically can negotiate enhancements and mitigate damage in your community. So the confluence of all that led us to hire Gilmore and King back in 2015 to come up with a master plan effort for this neighborhood. The things that we all realized, including the neighbors, was that this footprint, now everyone knows that the Housing Authority owns 2,300 units of public housing throughout the city. But half of our units are on this footprint, Pioneer Home, Central Village, McKinney Manor, and Alamos Oliver Towers. And so looking at the I-81 opportunity and repositioning these properties, it was determined that the location of these properties, which is located in the urban core, as you can see from the screensaver behind me, you know, being adjacent to Syracuse University and Upstate Hospital and St. Joseph, you know, three top major employers in the region, as well as close to downtown, and that you could really do a mixed income development in this neighborhood because of the footprint, because of its location and the size of the footprint under which SHA owns. And we thought this was meaningful because the other issue that was coming out at the time of all this master planning was this problem of concentrated poverty and the need to deconcentrate poverty in this community and upstate communities as well. So it was an opportunity to address a lot of needs. And we did the master plan back in 2016, which really called for reconnecting streets, getting rid of the super blocks where you currently have, which is very conducive to a lot of nefarious activities happening in public housing on that footprint, the wellness components, and many of the opportunity to get mixed income housing. And I know that a lot of people, when you talk about mixed income housing, especially in Syracuse, New York, often think about mixed income housing as an 80-20 mix, 80% market rate, 20% low income. You know, that was historically the way you did market rate back in the 50s and 60s. But HUD has really evolved over time, and the Syracuse Housing Authority Board of Commissioners was committed to making sure that the residents on this was going to be able to take advantage of the benefits of this, of the redevelopment on this footprint. And so HUD has a one-for-one replacement. So for the 1,000 units of public housing on this footprint, each one has to be replaced as we redevelop this neighborhood. And they also give out, HUD also gives out tenant protection vouchers. These are vouchers that if you relocate due to the redevelopment of a property, you have the right to return. In fact, your voucher will expire, so you'll definitely have to have the right to return to the redeveloped area when it's all said and done. And so we were, again, committed to the residents taking advantage of this opportunity. And the best way we felt to do that was to do the, you know, redevelopment in phases so that residents could stay on the footprint. They would only have to maybe move once from their old housing stock into maybe a new phase, first or second phase of the housing area. So it's more of a checkerboard approach. And you don't have all displacement because in addition to people moving off the footprint, very often they don't want to move twice. And so they don't move back. So we want to, again, the philosophy was to do this in a phasing manner so that the vast majority of the residents could take advantage of the redevelopment as it was all completed. And, you know, and so our approach was not to demolish the properties and displace the residents. Our approach to all of this was to invest in this neighborhood, a neighborhood that hasn't had any investment in over 50 years or more, and invite people into the community. So it was to get away from demolish and disperse and invest and invite. That's the approach that we were taking to this redevelopment on the East Adams footprint. We were able to develop and sign a term sheet with McCormick, Barron and Salsa, our master planner and development company out of Pittsburgh. They've been in business for 25 years and have done a number of these transformation communities, especially working with HUD and public housing. And so we are looking to start the master planning in the next couple of weeks. And when we say start master planning, we're really talking about starting with the resident leaders and having them help us put together the plan that will get the maximum amount of resident engagement and input and knowledge of what's going on going forward. Now you might say, well, what's the difference between the master planning you did back in 2016 and the one we're looking to do now? Well, this one puts a little bit more meat on the bones. It comes up with a greater diagram as to how many houses may go on each footprint, how much is it going to cost to put in the streets and infrastructure and the environmentals and marketing studies that have to go into all of this. So that's where we're, you know, looking to go. And, you know, I think that as what Stephanie talked about earlier in terms of the resident engagement and resident education, you know, those components are critical, because when you're talking about a redevelopment of this huge magnitude, and trying to make sure that all the residents understand what's going to happen to them and how, that's critical, because we've seen in other communities where they tried to do a transformation plan, and when the plan was completed, lawsuits engaged because residents felt that they were not properly educated on their rights, and the relocation plan was really a disbursement plan. So it really, and so knowing that when you do your relocation, and when you're doing your planning, the planning really has to be, we have a general timeline, but really the planning has to move at the speed of trust. As the residents feel that they trust you and what your understanding of their rights, the understanding of the plan and the level of commitment, that's how you keep advancing the plan along. But we are looking to do the master planning, hopefully get a plan in front of the Common Council this summer for approval, and then to the mayor's desk, so that we can start applying for some of those public and private dollars to bring the plan to fruition. Many of you may know about the HUD Choice Implementation Grant that does exactly what we're proposing in this neighborhood, in this community, and it brings anywhere near approximately of $30 to $35 million of investment. But $30 to $35 million probably only gets us one third of the where we need to be on this project. You know, this is a project, once it starts, probably through the phasing, will be done over a 10-year period of time and over hundreds of millions of dollars. And so in addition to the Choice Neighborhood Implementation Grant, you know, we're looking to New York State. We're going to be looking for some of the infrastructure bills that are out there. We're looking to negotiate some mitigations and enhancements for this community through the I-81 project. And we're looking for philanthropy. So it's a very, very exciting project. We think it's going to be not only transformative for the residents on the footprint, but also a real asset to this neighborhood to attract and retain employees and employees in the city and county.
That's all we have for our formal presentation. I know, Emily, you said you'd be our moderator extraordinaire to handle any questions that might come in. And just thanks, everyone, for having us today, and wanted to make sure you knew how to get in touch.
Thank you so much, everyone. I'll get us kicked off. So you talked about concentrated poverty, and we've all seen the news. We've heard about the issues that we're having in Syracuse. Do you have like a plan for measuring your success and kind of combating that with the plan you have here?
So part of the master planning process, as Bill mentioned, that might be a little different, is that there's benchmarks and goals that are sort of identified and baked into the plan, whether it's goals around changing and improving educational attainment, whether it's around income increasing, or whether it's around reduction in crime. There's probably, 10 indicators that will, part of that accountability we talked about, would be sort of baked in. And again, in partnership with residents, what larger goals do we want to see happen, and how are we going to measure that? So I know in other communities that our developer has worked in, they've shared with us the not just what the goals were, but their progress towards the goals, like doubling income in certain neighborhoods, increasing third grade reading levels by double, looking at employment and workforce participation levels. So through master planning, we'll identify what some of those benchmarks are and immediately start tracking and analyzing that data. I will say, Bill sort of facilitated this incredible process of selecting not just a master developer who knows how to build beautiful housing, but that they brought together a really strong team of, partners. And then, and one of those partners is Urban Strategies, and that they're a nonprofit organization that does this kind of people planning and people programming, like coordinating programs in a way that they've just been able to demonstrate really impactful results. So Bill, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I think that in addition to, you know, by partnering with Blueprint 15 and working towards having a highly amenitized, holistic approach to redevelopment. So while, you know, SHA is focusing in on rebuilding the high quality housing neighborhood with streets and wellness and making walkable, safe neighborhoods, you're also talking about opportunities for families to move in a more self-sufficient way, creating opportunities for them to, you know, go back to school, get a job, daycare, things that for them to help move their status in life forward. But also, we also know the benefits of having a mixed income community, whether it's residents who live on the footprint as a result of the baby boomers and want to be close to downtown or University Hill, or young people who are, you know, not married and they want, all they need is a, you know, one bedroom apartment and Wi-Fi. And they're also starting to work, you know, that would like to be on the footprint of where everything is happening. And the partnership with Blueprint and the Syracuse City School District to take King School in the footprint and make that a high performing neighborhood school. Those are the kinds of things that attracts families. We all know, I've been on city council for 8 years and on the Syracuse City School Board for 8 years. And we know the critical importance of a neighborhood attracting families based on the quality of the schools. And so King School will play a key role as becoming a high performing school. And you also have the two STEM schools in that neighborhood, the IT school, as well as what they're trying to do with Central Tech. So education is going to be a critical component to this, but we think that where the footprint is located will be able to attract market rate families as well.
Great, thank you so much. We've got a question kind of on that track. How will the purpose-built schools factor in with the schools already existing in the corridor, like Dr. King that you're talking about?
That's a great question. So for about, prior to the pandemic, part of our consulting engagement with Purpose Built is working with identify a school in your neighborhood, or some other Purpose Built communities decide to build a new school, build a whole new thing. And I have to say, we're very fortunate to be in a district where the superintendent is very forward thinking and said, no, we want to be part of this. But it involves a lot of staff time and training and in looking at different ways to operate and deliver instruction. So at the time when we started this embarked on this effort, the principal and I believe another administrative staff person were allowed to, you know, they went to Atlanta several times to see how the school worked, to have sort of a peer mentor relationship. And, you know, due to travel restrictions, we've been doing some stuff remotely, but really hopefully being able to open that back up again and really seeing how they manage the school, how they manage instruction. Project-based learning is at the core. And they've really schools that are modeled now after the, it's called the Drew Charter School, but this purpose-built model. Just recently, the superintendent and Blueprint 15 executed a formal MOU that the district is in support of, and not just in name and signature, but really behind. We meet with the staff all the time. So I think that planning for that, those shifts and changes, is at the forefront, and figuring out what kind of supports, financing, other, you know, professional development that they need, you know, to accomplish this is part of our job. So that formal relationship is there, it's committed, and it's engaged. That team is incredibly engaged with Purpose Built, with Blueprint. And I think we're on really solid footing to keep advancing that forward.
Great. Thanks, Stephanie. Next question is for Bill. Bill, you mentioned the I-81 challenges. In spite of DOT's study and conclusions, it feels like the decision on the way ahead, either patch up 81 versus take down and build the grid, is still not finalized. On Congressman Katko's March 4th meeting at the White House, he referred to the prioritization of the I-81 rebuild. Is the Housing Authority and the Allen Foundation advocating for a decision way ahead with the key representatives and stakeholders like the state, DOT, Congressman Katko, and others?
Yeah, we've been working with the New York State DOT, and we've been working with our local delegation of federal and state legislatures on this project for the past 10 years, whether it was CACO, whether it was the MFA, whether it was, you know, just been going on and on and on, it seems like. But yeah, we, New York State DOT has come out with the preferred concept. That was their recommendation to the Federal Highway Commission. Hopefully the Federal Highway Commission will come out with a process soon for engagement and final decision-making. Because we worked with I-81 way back when they had their stakeholder groups. And one of the options for the street grid was to, at the time, tear down the viaduct, but leave the on and off ramps in place. You know, we knew that was not going to work for this neighborhood. And so we were able to, working with the Center for Urban Design, come up with some renderings that showed how you can do the street grid under the overpass, under the rail station, as opposed to over it. And we also demonstrated or made it clear to the DOT that we were trying to create an urban core here, trying to create traffic, and that we were going to be breaking up our street super blocks and putting in streets to connect with that interstate business loop. And that was going to be a part of the plan. So that was a key factor. There's a lot of factors. But that was a key factor in coming for DOT, New York State DOT, coming up with the preferred option of the street grid. We'll see where that goes from there. But as I pointed out early on, the redevelopment of the SHA properties had to take place no matter what. The path that we were going on now was unsustainable, and we had to redevelop the neighborhood. The timeline on when it will start, you know, could be in March of 2000, could be in 2022, but we've been dealing with this for so long and putting off this redevelopment, we decided that probably the best practice would be to start our redevelopment furthest away from I-81 so we can get started and then see how this all plays out with I-81.
Thank you. Next question, will you include area landlords in your plans for Blueprint 15?
Yeah, of course. Any stakeholders in the area, I mean, it's going to be a partnership. It's not like we mentioned, it's not just about the public housing component that we want to have affordable, high quality opportunities throughout that footprint, the southern half. And we can't do it without quality investment and quality landlords. So absolutely.
Thanks, Stephanie. Next question. This individual worships at a church in the neighborhood, and there are plenty of others as well, I'm sure. How are you reaching out to these churches because the congregants will be impacted?
I can speak a little bit on that. So we're currently planning to hold a meeting with all the faith-based institutions just to provide kind of an up-to-date as to where we are and ensuring that they have an opportunity to engage in this process, because we know that they are very integral in their resident and community engagement. So, you know, we'll be reaching out and, you know, having a meeting. You can, whoever asked that question, I can be sure to connect with you to ensure that your particular church is included in that effort.
Thanks, Arlena. Next question. Based on your resident engagement efforts to date, what are the most common reservations you've heard about this project from within the community? And how does this initiative intend to incorporate and or address these concerns in the master planning and future stages of the project?
Well, I can talk to the process we went through back in 2016 with planning with Gilmore Keene. And I think the residents realize and understand that the path that we're on is unsustainable, but let's face it, who wants to move? Nobody wants to move, whether it's for I-81 or that they don't want to move as it relates to, you know, redevelopment of our properties, but they're just old enough now that even if we try to replace what we have and we currently have, somebody's gonna have to move out of the apartment just to make these places meet codes and visibility and all those issues that haven't been addressed in the past 50 years. And so, residents in this footprint, many of them are excited about what can happen. Many of us are excited about the I-81 challenge. But let's face it, many residents have a high degree of anxiety about having to relocate and what really is going to happen. Because when you're involved with government, People are so distrustful of government these days, and you can make all these great promises, but until it really hits them, they're always going to be cautious and have a lot of anxiety. And I think that's one of the beauties of doing this redevelopment in phase, because once they see that first phase go up, then they can say, oh, okay, this is real, this is good, I want to be a part of it, when do I move? And just to dovetail a little bit, it was funny when we, Syracuse Housing Authority, used the low-income tax credit program to build the 50 homes on the South Side. And I remember there were a lot of neighborhood groups that said, oh, you know, they were questioning the houses and the location of the houses and how far they were spread apart from each other. And I, you know, joking with someone, I said, look, these houses, the length between the two houses are greater than some of the houses on the east side, you know, spaced between the two. But there was a lot of anxiety as the house was being built and questions all the time. But when we got through building those 50 homes, those residents were saying, hey, Bill, when are you going to build the next 50? And that's what's going to happen in this process. Once you build that first phase and people can see it, touch it, feel it, then it becomes real.
I'll just add, and Arlena, please chime in, that obviously, like Bill said, when we do surveys, right, how are you feeling? How's it going? Either in talking to people or on our cards, they've circled both excited and worried, right? Like there's multiple emotions and multiple feelings. I think Bill touched upon, history has shown that government, there's a lack of trust in government, a lack of trust that all these wonderful things that you say. So we're just going to have to do, and we're going to have to show and by leading and by, you know, doing like Bill said, showing those houses, showing the quality, showing the availability, that thing that we built looks exactly like what we talked about in the planning, and that we're going to keep rolling that forward. There's a ton of apprehension, you know, there's a ton of, and that's what I hope, you know, as we talk about, like, we were really intentional about creating a barrier reduction fund, because we don't know what some of the barriers are going to be to that smooth transition. We want to make sure that you're not just surviving through this thing, but thriving, and how, you know, so we don't have all the answers, but we're trying to anticipate, at least from, you know, different perspectives, that that we're as thoughtful and well prepared as possible through this process, and that people really do feel like at any time they can have their questions answered, that they know just as much as we know. And I think that's really important.
And I would just say to add, a lot of people have a lot of you know, apprehension just with regard to COVID. How is all this master planning going to happen in COVID? And so in working with, you know, Syracuse Housing Authority and Urban Design Associates, we're, you know, making sure that there's going to be multiple different formats for people to be able to participate. You know, we saw the huge digital divide that exists. A lot of people don't have access to technology and might not be able to look at updates on a website. So ensuring that there's, you know, physical bulletin boards where people can say, yes, I like this idea. No, I don't like this idea, so that their voice is also heard. So there are a lot of different formats and phasing approaches that we all are kind of trying to work on collaboratively to ensure that people don't have barriers to participating in this initiative.
Great, thank you. Next question, kind of on the same lines in terms of the residents. So the original purpose-built community in Atlanta saw a very high rate of displacement. Given your emphasis on preventing that, are there practices from that process that you have identified as contributing to displacement that you can improve upon?
Sure. And, you know, I know, Bill, you know deeply, you know, about what kinds of things are required and what kinds of things we hope to enhance on what's required. I think what we're trying to do is this sort of runway, if you will, of trust building. Bill mentioned this can only happen at the speed of trust, so that that people feel like, okay, I know exactly what my options are. I know exactly when or about when I would be afforded an opportunity to return if I did have to relocate. And that all the supports would be available to facilitate that. So I think for us, and I'm not sure back then, 20, you know, whatever years ago, if they had that kind of infrastructure in place and able to not just say, oh, Stephanie moved over to whatever street, we'll make sure in a year or so when her unit's available, we get in touch with her. That's not the intent at all. It's all about like regular constant communication throughout all of the phases. to make sure people know not just what's going on, like, yeah, they finally started, there's a hole in the ground for phase two, or but that, like, how are you doing? What do you need any assistance with? Are you having any connectivity problems, like getting to your faith organization, to your medical appointments, to whatever, you know, connects you to this community? And I'll just say the other part is not just sort of like saying, oh yeah, of course you'll have a place to live, but oh, you are going to want to come back. We are really trying to do something special here and get excitement around returning. Not for those of us who have moved, I'm sure everyone on here, you don't wish it on anybody. It's terrible. It's hard. It's disruptive with people with means. So we want to make sure that that's as smooth as possible, but that people are just so excited about returning through, like, not just the housing component, but these other amenities, through these high quality educational and workforce opportunities, through the health and wellness. If, you know, there's a year round exercise facility in the footprint, to all kinds of different wellness programs, that you're just thrilled to come back. You're excited to come back. I think it's a different, for me, it feels like a different mindset about not just saying, of course you can come back if you want, but really like generating excitement around, like, you're kind of lucky. Like, yeah, you get to like, your first crack coming back.
Great, thank you. Let's see, will there be an effort to preserve a portion of Pioneer Homes, since, as Bill, as you pointed out, that it is historic?
It's historic, being the first in New York State, and one of the first five in the nation, but it's not historic as on the historic preservation. And so, but again, as we go through this process with the residents, you know, that's how some of those issues unfold. You know, you hear from the residents, and they may say, well, you know, we want Wilson Park to stay, or we want this one building or community center to stay as a, you know, replication of, remind us of our history. Those kind of things come out in planning and engagement with the residents. And so we'll see, but, you know, this footprint, we'll try to maximize the capacity and density will grow. We're looking to have it be the kind of neighborhood that will attract some commercial use, that will provide some permanent jobs in addition to the construction jobs as well. So whether or not we have some remnants of the old Pioneer Homes as a reminder of years gone by will be, you know, kind of determined as we talk to residents going forward.
Thanks, Bill. What is the exact relationship between Blueprint 15 and SHA, and what type of decision-making authority does Blueprint have around SHA's redevelopment plan?
Well, I'll just start that. I think it was the fall of 2019 that just as an act of partnership, Purpose-Built Communities, Blueprint 15, and the Syracuse Housing Authority executed an MOU that we're all committed to this sort of bold vision for transformation and in sort of implementing this purpose-built model. But we'll be clear, the development, SHA owns their property. Like, they are working with the master developer on the stuff that they own. We're trying to complement that effort with these other legs of the stool, in addition to scattered site, you know, housing development or mixed use or rental opportunities in other parts of the area. But we, you know, like I said, there's five representatives on our board that are in somehow affiliated with SHA, two commissioners, Bill, and two residents. And that to me is like, it's all about transparency and partnership. And, you know, if you ever could see our email boxes, you would know how much we work together on a daily basis and just how open the Housing Authority has been and welcoming us to their place. I know my way around that place like nobody's business. So it's been, in that respect, you know, a great partnership.
Yeah, I just wanted to add. So as Stephanie talked about, we're all committed to this mission of high quality housing for residents, wellness center, and a highly amenitized neighborhood. But a large part of the real checks and balances comes in with the housing, with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They're the ones that make sure that the tenants are protected and give them their rights. We don't get a dime from the Department of Housing and Urban Development unless we have a plan that's approved by the neighbors. If we're gonna be using, and I'm sure we will, New York State Department of Housing and Community Renewal dollars to redevelop these properties. They come in with a design book that you have to follow. So, you know, it's really kind of set up for success for the residents and for the neighborhood by using these public-private dollars and getting your plan accepted with all of the regulatory requirements between HUD and New York State HCR.
Great, thank you. So we've got a couple questions in the chat around different initiatives in the city, specifically Brady Faith that's on Gifford Street and other social services that are kind of in this blueprint. Do you have services already picked out that will be specifically located in Blueprint 15, or how will those be chosen?
I think through master planning, you know, we expect that some amenities, for example, you know, through engagement that maybe not, but I suspect the development of an early learning center, for example, will come through. That's a huge part of the, you know, sort of cradle the zero to college pipeline. And no, we have not identified a partner, for example, we don't even know where it's going to go yet. That's what master planning is all about. Same thing about, sort of a health and wellness facility, or will it be part of the first floor of a housing structure, or will it be a standalone building? Will it be how it will be operated? You know, we don't know the answer to those questions, but know that we want, you know, partners engaged in that effort. And again, everything for us is about best in class. So that's what we're looking for is, you know, who can deliver that and what kinds of resources would they need in order to achieve that goal.
Great, thank you. We've got time for one more question. So will you have placement agents to help people throughout this whole process of moving and potentially moving back?
I don't know, Bill, you can speak better to the Uniform Relocation Act and those requirements, but that's, you know, again, like we talked about, this anti-displacement effort and working with the Housing Authority, with the City of Syracuse and others, is to ensure that not only does the project meet those required guidelines, we really do hope to exceed in the sense of this idea that, like, there's an actual relationship built throughout that timeline, and that folks are able to connect with a human, whether it's, you know, their family support services connector at the Housing Authority, whether it's a staff person at Blueprint 15. We're all going to be working together and sharing information throughout that process. But that, there's going to be a lot of help and assistance anticipated throughout, not just the actual move. Again, like, that's just part of it. It's like, once you get settled, touch in, say, how's it going? Are you still able to get to church on Sunday? How's it, you know, what kinds of, are there any additional barriers that are making things difficult for you? So that is part of our strategy and our plan. I don't know, Bill, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, you know, again, my hope is that we're going to be able to keep as many people on the footprint now to remain. And so you don't have those issues about someone leaving public housing, having to go into the private sector, but can't get into that house because they still have, they can't rent that house because they still have a National Grid bill from 2010. We're trying to avoid all of that by keeping everybody on the footprint. But, you know, as we put this partnership together, that's the purpose of the partnership with Blueprint and Urban Strategies, is to try to address those issues, because we know there's going to be those kinds of unique concerns for many families and residents. So, that's the intent of the partnership.
Great, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. So please join me in thanking Stephanie, Bill, and Arlena for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for the questions.
Thank you.